All right, this is the Father's Day edition of the Sports Medicine Broadcast. I'm Bubba Wilson with Dr. Michael Eisen, who is a physician and an athletic trainer. So that's a unique one that doesn't happen very often. So if you don't mind, give us a little history about yourself.
It started out, I think, my father was a physician. He was actually a general and vascular surgeon. And for whatever reason, he used to receive this journal called The Physician in Sports Medicine.
Yep.
And in high school, I used to start out just, I used to read it. When it come in the mail, I would take it out of his stack of journals, and I would read it for myself.
Then put it back in for him, and he wouldn't know it was gone.
I think he had so much, you know, in terms of continuing education and whatnot, that he didn't miss it. But I, for whatever reason, I just, that was something out of all his journals that came into the house that I would just absorb for myself.
Right. So tell us, you know, a little bit about yourself from there. You're an athletic trainer. Where'd you go to college for that? What, I know you were with the in minor league baseball for a while, so just kind of touch base on that, and then we'll jump into the good stuff, so to speak.
Okay. My roots are in athletic training. Chuck Ash, who recently retired, was my mentor, as well as Doc Anderson. And this was at Troy University, which is now Troy University. At the time, was Troy State University.
Right.
From there, Doc Anderson, who ran the curriculum, suggested that I go see what it's like at Baton Rouge. And so I interviewed there and was accepted. And when I got there, that was time for a new change of shift. And that was when Jack Marucci came to power. He transferred from Florida State. Those of you who are baseball fanatics know that Marucci is a bat. And
right.
that's the gentleman. And he's just an unbelievable man. He started in his yard and backyard, rather, in the garage. And he developed an industry. But even beyond that, he's just a wonderful man. And he brought his staff with him, who are just to this day still influences on what I do. From there, right after I attained my master's, somehow the Tampa had a new baseball team. I reached out to them, spoke to a gentleman who's now in charge there, Ron Porterfield, and said, you know, he gave me a shot. And so I was with an extended season single A baseball team working with the advanced rookies. And that was an experience in itself. You know, just before you even break from your two-year team assignment, you're at training camp there in St. Pete, and you're seeing guys that, you know, you had baseball cards your whole life were walking in, and you go out every morning, set up the field, and there's that fresh-cut grass, and it was quite an experience.
How many years did you do that?
I just did that for one season, and for whatever.
That was a long decade that season, huh?
It was. You know, we came in second place in our division. We almost won it, which was, you know, would have been topping on the icing on the cake, so to speak. But it was an incredible experience, and a lot of what I still do today. You know, Ron Porterfield, he was an excellent athletic trainer. He taught me so much about throwing shoulder.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, my dad played professional football in the '60s, and so the movie that kind of was with that was North Dallas 40.
Wow, yeah.
And I asked him, I said, how real was that? And he said, it's pretty accurate. And,
uh-huh.
And I think after a year of minor league baseball and talked to some guys I know, they say, you know, Bull Durham was pretty accurate in a lot of ways,
yeah,
too, when you look at it. So all right, so talk a little bit about, you know, so you then go to medical school after that?
I had to take some prerequisites. I still hadn't fulfilled things like organic chemistry.
You should never have to fulfill organic
chemistry. You know, it's one of these things where they try to weed out students. It's the weed-out class, so to speak. But I don't know. I found it enjoyable. Maybe it was just because I was a little bit older returning to school. I didn't feel like it was such a pressure-oriented task.
Okay.
And during that time, I was working outpatient for athletic training at a large group called Health South.
Yeah.
And great people along the way there as well. So.
Yeah. Okay. So you talked this morning about preventative maintenance of the overhead throwing shoulder, and you talked about you hit on some great topics and a bunch, and one of my favorite quotes you put in there too was if you need a reason to do surgery on a throwing athlete, you get an MRI, and you know, and they all want an MRI, and then they're going to see something. Well, something's wrong in there. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean that's the cause of your symptoms, and that's all. I know that's I've worked in an orthopedic office. That's a hard sell.
Yes.
You don't need an image or extra imaging, and when you get it, that doesn't mean that that's the problem you're having. And I know that's got to be tough. And so how do you handle that situation when that comes up?
There's a colleague that I work with, Dr. Pinert, and he always says an MRI never fixed anything.
Right.
And so, and I tell them there's other studies. There's one that I like to quote to them, and I didn't place it today, is that if you do an MRI on an overhead throwing athlete, professional athlete, it takes about a week for changes that are seen on an MRI to go away. So you will actually see mm-hmm. changes dissipate if you follow them serially on an MRI. And it's just another bullet point that I add to them in addition to the ones I presented today. It's well known that throwers have their own unique injuries.
Right.
And often, like I said, we'll see them on x-ray first, and you just need to take the approach that, well, let's try to fix something in terms of rehabilitation before we jump into this venture or surgery, which once you alter the normal anatomy in a throwing shoulder, and it's already been altered because we know there's so-called osseous adaptations,
right.
The capsular adaptations, the whole shoulder undergoes adaptations. That's the whole series behind GERD stretching and sleeper
total
stretch.
Motion and
yeah,
all,
total,
yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Total arc. And it, I think you jump the gun and just to say I'm doing my part as a clinician because I'm doing an MRI is a disservice for the patient.
Right. My GP ordered one. Okay, but they didn't get contrast. They didn't do ab reviews. And so it's a pointless, worthless cost of money, you know, to do that study. So,
right.
Yeah.
Or they'll do contrast, but it'll be IV.
Yeah.
And I'm just, okay, all right.
Yeah, great. We're not looking at your brain.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was lucky enough in 2009 to go to Dr. Andrews' shoulder conference when it was in Houston. I'm out of Houston. And they had some great stats. Now, they may have changed since then, and I'm the first to admit I haven't kept up with some of that. But what he said that, has stuck with me the whole time is if you play, and this is the big one for youth baseball, if you play year-round baseball, which is 8 months or more a year, you're six times more likely to have an injury requiring surgery. Okay? Now, that one is not glaring to me. That kind of makes perfect sense. But where it really hits home, if you can do it, in my mind, is if you take the throwing shoulder, which you just discussed, and if you're not in the major leagues currently, and they put a scope in your throwing shoulder, and they don't have to do anything, just stick it in there, disrupt the capsular pressures, drive it around and take a peek. And again, you're not in the major leagues. You have a 0% chance of making it to the major leagues as a pitcher. So really, once you put the scope in the shoulder, you're doomed. And what do they say? 25% of salaries are spent for pitchers being on the IR.
Mm-hmm.
We got to change something. It is an epidemic on Tommy John's.
Absolutely.
You know, in the throwing shoulder, it's all interrelated. It's all the kinetic chain. And it's a hard sell to understand. You've got to sit when your ankle's hurt as a pitcher because you're going to blow out your shoulder or elbow in their parlance.
And for me, it's a tough one, too, because growing up in Florida, I played fall ball, and then you played high school ball, and you played summer ball. And I did it. And I look at these recommendations that I'm telling or informing these patients and the parents about, and I didn't do it, but for some reason, I don't know, I guess I wasn't much of an athlete, but I didn't incur those injuries. But it's true. Yeah. But what I've seen is you see people playing for their high school. They're playing these showcase leagues. They're traveling across the country. And it's just
right. Multiple teams at the same time.
And you tell them, oh, by the way, you have to shut down. And that look you get across the office, it's just.
Right. It's like you just told them that you're going to have to move to Mars.
Yeah. What were you expecting? What were you expecting me to tell me? You've been throwing in pain for how many months now? And
right. Yeah, how'd that work out for you? I'm taking care of it on your own.
Yeah.
The other thing that I thought was really, really telling from Dr. Andrews is he said with a pitcher, now we're talking about pitchers, because a second baseman with a shoulder injury is totally different than a center fielder, a catcher, or a pitcher. But he said for a pitcher, basically, if it's a shoulder elbow issue, he goes, realistically, they need 3 months on the DL to get better. And I thought that was an amazing stat that mm-hmm. it's not a 15-day DL trip.
No.
It's if you really want to get rid of this, it's 3 months.
And that's
minimum.
And you're telling me you're a baseball fan and you always hear that announced, oh, here's a 15-day DL, and all of a sudden it parlays into the third and you know it's coming.
Right.
It's just an elbow strain and the
elbow strain, we're debating are we gonna have surgery or are we gonna try to throw.
Yeah.
And he can't throw, so we're gonna fix it.
Right. That's just
I think the other thing that you touched on when you were talking about the advanced throwers 10, which is one of probably my favorite set of exercises, and I think you can take the throwers 10 in a high school setting and pick your favorite 4 or 5 for time and mm-hmm. still get benefit out of that. But you talked about light weights.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Littner out of Houston, who I know real well, he's with the Astros, and his thing is in season they do no more than 5 pounds. And And I found that interesting. I thought, okay, well, that's an adult, you know, that he's talking about. And so I said, why? And he goes, they're throwing the ball. Why do we want to add more stresses? And, you know, and then you want to slap yourself in the head and go, well, it makes perfect sense. Why did you ask a dumb question? But so if you don't mind, talk a little bit about the stresses and then the need, and again, kind of circle back around with the need for those lighter weights like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, the stresses being the forces that are seen in the pitching windup or the pitching motion. Again, the fastest motions ever recorded is when the shoulder enters internal rotation at 7,000 meters per second. As I touched on in the presentation, the actual forces on the ulnar collateral ligament are greater than what it can tolerate when you're going through the windup. During the days with Tampa Bay, I used to carry around a sling of just 3 to 5 pound weighted balls, which were shaped like a baseball. And the guys knew if you did 3 sets of 15 with 3 pounds, you went up to 4 pounds, and you started again, and you gradually progressed. And they knew that you didn't go beyond 5 because, as Dr. Littner said, there's no point in progressing beyond. And as I said in the talk, once you start going beyond a certain range of weight, you start using additional resources. You start pulling in lats versus an infraspinatus. You start, you know, you start to recruit other muscles, traps versus.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah, you alter your mechanics for right. the sake of trying to get that weight up. I'm looking for, I just had it and I've lost it on one of the things you said that I wanted you to touch on.
Okay.
The summation of speed phenomenon.
Oh, yeah. That. Yeah.
So just touch on that a little bit again as to what that is and what that means.
So going through the pitching motion, there are so many phases that you must go through to successfully deliver the ball with motion, control, velocity. And what that statement says, summation of speed phenomenon, is that once you start introducing changes within, the kinetic changes start to have an effect later on down the road. And it's about maintaining minimum input to get maximum output. And that's the basic summation of that, or the summary of that statement.
Okay. Yeah, and I think one of the things I started telling individuals, and I just one of the deals, you talk about, you know, your title of your presentation is preventative maintenance of the overhead throwing shoulder. Well, one way to prevent maintenance is like a car. Don't put as many miles on it.
Right.
You know, less is more in the overhead athlete, be that baseball, swimming, tennis, you know, volleyball,
softball.
Outside hitter stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, softball. That was one, too. So what is the one thing we always hear about softball pitchers? Oh, it's a different motion. They can pitch all day long, every day. They can't.
No.
Lots of slap injuries, you know, lots of little league shoulder injuries, per se. You still get elbow injuries,
right.
even though they're not in that valgus, but they get some.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
The forces aren't there. I think they're recorded around 3,000 meters a second with the shoulder, but still, you know, it's entirely different, but it's still the same outcome.
Right. Right. And I think one of the things you also touched on, and we talked about it, like if you have a hurt ankle, it's 32 newtons to tear your ulnar collateral ligament, and the throwing stresses are 35. Well, again, that's why everything has to be strong, which is one of the misnomers of Tommy John surgery. Well, I'm going to come back stronger. No, you don't necessarily come back stronger because we had to fix something that wasn't broken initially that you broke, but you've had 18 months to get all these faults taken care of that put you on the operating table to begin with.
Absolutely.
You get your motion back to where it should be, even in your elbow, but with your shoulder. Your trunk is strong. Your lower body's strong, where a lot of those forces are generated. The old power pitchers that had the dirty, you know, drive leg because their knee was on the ground. They're pushing so hard off the mound. And all those things are done, and your mechanics are better now. You know, it's because your calf was injured when you tried to take the mound, and that's why, you know, your ulnar collateral went out. Besides the accumulation of pitches over time, that, you know, that rubber band can only stretch and retract so many times before it's gone.
And during fellowship, I worked with a group of orthopedists, New Jersey Orthopedics Institute, Dr. McInerney, salt of the earth, absolutely wonderful man. Old school physician and surgeon, one of a kind. You don't meet him like that anymore. Absolutely just unbelievable man. And what he had a biomechanicist on staff. So before he would even touch the patient in terms of a surgical approach, he'd have him say, look, let's have someone take a look at you. Is there something we can alter or change that will address the problem altogether? And it was nice to meet you, you know?
Right.
Let's take, and I think that's really what we need to do, and that's what I stressed today in the presentation. In this day and age, with all the multimedia that we have, we should be recording our pitchers.
Right. Well, I know there's some baseball teams out there whose scouts now have gotten – they're pretty, you know, savvy on the Internet, and every mom and dad posts their kids' stats. Well, okay, they're going to – let's say I'm a great pitcher. I'm not. But they're going to look at me and say, okay, he's, you know, top – he's fifth round or better just off the top of our head. Let's start researching him. Oh, look at all these times he's thrown. Look at all these pitches he's thrown. Yeah, no, there's 10th round, 15th round. I'm losing draft status because I played on multiple teams in the right. summer. I'm going to Vegas in the winter. What am I doing? And so they're getting smart enough now to know, you know, it's an epidemic that they can't draft a healthy arm.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. And they're paying them a lot of money, you know, to go play at that level. And so they're saying, all right, we're going to start looking at your past history, not only your medical history, but your past playing history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so what is it? I think the other stat that Dr. Meister came out with that I think was out of Sports Illustrated, if I'm correct, is 75% of major league pitchers born in America were born north of the Mason-Dixon line. You know, they can't play year-round.
All right.
So, you know, all the good hitters grew up north, south of the Mason-Dixon line, but the pitchers were all up north.
Yeah.
You know, because in the fall they're playing football or soccer, and the winter they can't go play, and really they can't play till late spring, early summer.
Saving grace.
Yeah. They got a healthy arm.
Mm-hmm.
So. Anything else you'd like to add? I don't want to take up our time. Like I say, we could do this for hours.
All right. I think name the game comes back to prevention. It's as simple as that. And if we're not doing that, that's a disservice for the athlete.
All right. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.